ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय
ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय
ॐ
नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय
Reading Canto 3, Chapter 3, Text 11, 12, and 13. Buddha's continuing. Like last night, he's continuing to describe when Krishna came to kill demons, he killed some of the demons and caused the killing to be done by some others, like Balaram. So text 11, of kings like Shambhara, Dvidvita, Banamura, Bauvala, and many other demons such as Dantavakra, some he killed himself, and some he caused to be killed by others. Parentheses, Sri Bhavadev, etc. Then, O Vidura, the Lord caused all the kings, both the enemies and those on the side of your fighting nephews, to be killed in the battle of Kurukshetra. All those kings were so great and strong that the earth seemed to shake as they traversed the war field. Duryodhana was bereft of his fortune and duration of life because of the intricacy of ill advice given by Karna, Dushasana, and Saubala. When he lay on the ground with his followers, his thighs broken, although he was powerful, the Lord was not happy to see the scene. Purport. The fall of Duryodhana, the leading son of Dhritarashtra, was not pleasing to the Lord, although he, the Lord, was on the side of Arjuna, and it was he who advised Bhima how to break the thighs of Duryodhana while the fight was going on. The Lord is constrained to award punishment upon the wrongdoer, but he is not happy to award such punishments because the living entities are originally his parts and parcels. He is harder than the thunderbolt for the wrongdoer and softer than the rose for the faithful. The wrongdoer is misled by bad association and by ill advice, which is against the established principles of the Lord's order, and thus he becomes subject to punishment. The surest path to happiness is to live by the principles laid down by the Lord and not disobey his established laws, which are enacted in the Vedas and the Puranas for the forgetful living beings. Not this past Sunday, but the Sunday before, I was in Tuaco for the Sunday program, and a 25, 26-year-old young man from an Orthodox Jewish background came to the temple for the first time, and it was a little bit more than a curiosity visit. It was a curiosity visit, but he actually had some interest to understand, and he wanted actually to One of the questions he asked in a private discussion was he wanted to know what translation of Bhagavad Gita to read and how to select a teacher. And he prefaced his question by saying a couple years ago somebody asked him how, if one wanted to become a follower of the Jewish faith, what should he do? He said, I was silent for a full minute because I was thinking, wow, there's so many different varieties of Judaism. There's Hasidic, and there's Orthodox, and there's Reformed, and there's... And then based upon those different divisions, there are different points of emphasis, and there are different teachers and rabbis, and how to advise somebody, how do you become a Jew, and what does it mean? So he said, similarly, probably in your religion, there's different varieties, right? And so even the Bhagavad Gita, there's probably different versions of the Bhagavad Gita, different presentations of the Bhagavad Gita, different teachers that can teach those different presentations. How do you select a teacher and which version of Bhagavad Gita? What was his question? So he wants to study and arranged for Chandrasekhar Maharshi to teach him. See how it works. But his first question was, in our Jewish faith, as well as the Islamic faith, because I've studied that, there's this principle that says there's laws given by God. It's very important for a person of the Jewish faith to know the laws given by God. And there's this notion that says, if you know the laws and follow the laws, you're blessed by God. If you don't know the laws or don't follow the laws, then you don't have that blessing of God. Is there something similar? So what Prabhupada is writing here is the something similar, which we've heard so many times. I said, most certainly, that our founder Acharya has described religion means laws given by God, and a religious person is one who follows the laws given by God. And one who follows the laws given by God is protected by those laws. Dharma raksha, rakshata. And the converse. So, the surest path to happiness is to live by the principles laid down by the Lord and not to disobey His established laws, which are enacted in the Vedas and the Puranas for the forgetful living entities. Then, of course, there's a higher platform than being religious, and that's being transcendental. Being transcendental doesn't mean I don't care for the laws given by God, but rather it's the purpose behind the laws given by God. And for this individual, it's get the blessings of God. And get the blessings of God translates into dharma artha. You follow the laws given by God and you will prosper. That's the blessing that's wanted. Artha. And kama is the driving principle behind the whole machine. Dharma artha kama. And even the idea of moksha largely is a attain heaven notion, where, you know, it's another enjoyment, higher enjoyment, not moksha in the liberation sense, freed altogether from these activities. In the purport, Prabhupada writes that the Lord is constrained to award punishment upon the wrongdoer. If that was true, then that would mean karma mimamsa philosophy is right. Because above God is what he is constrained to do. There's something constraining him. There's something above him. So it's not literally that this is an obligation by some higher principle or higher authority or higher reality. That he's a pawn being moved by that higher reality. He's constrained by his own affection. And his own affection is, there are living entities who are like a father that would like his large family to be peaceful amongst one another. And so there are standards the father sets that the family should follow so that they can remain peaceful. And then if one of the children consistently disobeys a principle, then some correction must come. And according to the severity of deviation, then the correction comes. It's not that the Lord desires, he gets some satisfaction out of giving correction or punishment to an errant son. Sometimes Prabhupada describes like this that how the admonishing feature of material nature is something like a father who has an undisciplined son. He tries everything to discipline the son and it fails. He puts that son under a strict teacher. He uses, there's some term for that in British terminology. A strict disciplinarian. So the father's not doing the strict disciplinary action, but he places his son in the care of somebody who does that strict disciplinary, a stern, to get the term, to reform the son. So material nature is like that. The laws of nature are there not so that living entities can suffer, but it's to correct. It's to, there's two things, facilitate and to correct. Have a desire to enjoy separately. So an illusory appearance as if one is enjoying separately is provided, and a built-in corrective mechanism. The corrective mechanism is, it's not happiness at all. It's miserable. So when there's misery, not that the Lord delights, haha, they were not feeling nice towards me, so now they are going to get theirs, they'll be miserable. So he's not, he's constrained by his own loving disposition to reciprocate with living entities in from the position of being neutral. Like Krishna describes in the ninth chapter of Bhagavad Gita about his relationship with the cosmos, and he describes that he's neutral. I'm unaffected by all these things. Situated as though neutral. So he's neutral at the same time he's not neutral. He's reciprocating. He's not neutral like a stone. He's neutral in a sense, name dveshosti napriyaha. At the same time, napriyaha, there are those that are very dear to him. He says both, right, in the Bhagavad Gita. But that's that holding dear to him, those who hold him dear to them, is a natural reciprocation. So, the Lord is constrained to award punishment upon the wrongdoer, but that constraint is self-imposed, it's his own affection. And another very important point is that Duryodhana is bereft of his fortune and duration of life because of the intricacy of ill advice given by Karna, Dushasana, and Sobala. Who is Sobala? Sobala is Gandhari's sister. Because Gandhari's father, excuse me, Gandhari's brother, not Gandhari's sister, Gandhari was the son of Suvala. And the son of Suvala is Sovala, or Shakuni. So, the way that Mahabharata is narrated, it's very clear that the person who corrupted the envious Duryodhana was Shakuni. Like his father, Dhritarashtra, Duryodhana was wishing to rule, and he was envious of those who were the rightful heirs to the throne because he wanted to rule. But being envious, envy can be checked by religious principle. Envy can be eradicated by bhakti. But minus bhakti, just following what's being said here in the purport about the rules or laws given by God, if one, it's like, you know, one may have a tendency to be a thief, but if you obey the laws of the state, you don't steal. Although you may have a tendency, etc. There may be a tendency for something bad, but that tendency can be checked by obedience to a law or a governing principle. So you just don't do that bad thing. So Duryodhana had envy. The scene, in quick summary, the sons of Pandu, or rather Yudhisthira, was born first. Gandhari was pregnant first, and her pregnancy went for a long time. She was, as they say today, overdue. And Kunti gave birth first to Yudhisthira, which meant, and everybody knew it, Yudhisthira would then become the king following Pandu. Whereas if Gandhari's sons were born first, those sons would, because Dhritarashtra couldn't become king, but if her sons were born first, her sons would become king. But her sons weren't born first. Yudhisthira was born first. And when Dhritarashtra was born out of one of the 100 pots, ill omen, so like wicked Duryodhan, was known by everybody. Bidura advised, get rid of this child, bring ruination to the whole dynasty. Do something, but don't keep in the royal family this child. He couldn't do that. So the Pandavas grew up in the forest until Pandu died. And when the Pandavas returned, they were happy. Everyone understood Yudhisthira would become the prince, would become the king, but the cousins were happy with one another because they had grown up separate and now they were young boys and playing. Except that Bhima was so powerful that when he would play, you know, they'd play games and he'd be like, pick one of the boys up and throw them. And he just was so powerful. And Duryodhan couldn't stand it. Shukuni had, like Kamsa, accompanied Devaki. After Devaki's marriage to Vasudev, Kamsa, the brother of the newly married queen, or the, in Devaki was the Brahmani, no, the queen of Vasudev. He accompanied his sister to Vasudev's residence. So Shukuni did that. The marriage was in Kandahar, and Gandahar, and then after the marriage, Shukuni accompanied Gandhari back to Hastinapur and stayed for some time, and then he went back to his kingdom. Later, when the boys were growing up, he again visited. And he makes this confidential plan, a murder plot, to take care of Bhima, particularly. So the plan of poisoning Bhima, disposing of Bhima, is made. When that fails, the Pandavas are, you know, they're continuing to grow up, and Dhritarashtra is very disturbed. Turmoil is going on. Balaram had spent some time in Hastinapur teaching the boys the art of fighting with a club. He detected there's this hostility, very, very intense. So when he went back to Dwarka, he reported that to Dwarka, so Krishna sent Akura to go and examine the situation. Akura stayed for some time. And when before he left, so he knew fully what was going, the intrigue that was going on, he advised Dhritarashtra to give this up. Details and details, but Dhritarashtra couldn't give up his plan. When Akura was gone, Dhritarashtra pondered on Akura's words. It was true that Pandu's sons were the rightful heirs to the kingdom. That could not be denied. It was especially clear that the eldest of them, Yudhisthira, was qualified to be the king. The king had seen how the prince was noted for his honesty, patience, kindness, and unswerving adherence to duty. Along with his brothers, he was a firm favorite of the people. The citizens loved Pandu, and it seemed to them that he returned to live among them as his sons. Everywhere people were speaking of their desire to see Yudhisthira installed as the king. Dhritarashtra had heard of their talks, quote, "Now we shall have a qualified prince. Why should the blind Dhritarashtra remain king? Let us place the pious Yudhisthira on the throne. He will surely be a righteous and benevolent ruler." Dhritarashtra consulted with Bhishma, Vidura, and the Brahmins. They all decided that Yudhisthira should be installed as prince regent. The ceremony was soon performed, and the people rejoiced. Well, most of the people. Duryodhana, however, was seething. How had his father bypassed him to make Yudhisthira the prince regent? When Bhima sneered at his distress, making it even more unbearable, he went with Karna and Dushasana to discuss with Shukuni a way to eradicate the Pandavas. So in the verse here is the ill advice of Karna, Dushasana, and Saubala. Shukuni's eyes narrowed as Duryodhana and the others vented their rage. He pressed his fingertips together to think. The classic. The only answer is, he said finally, to get the Pandavas out of Hastinapur to a place where they can be killed without interference. We should somehow contrive to have them burned to death, making it seem like an accident. That was pretty quick. Duryodhan smiled, but Karna was not sure. He did not like Shukuni's devious ways. Quote, "Only cowards resort to deceit and underhanded methods. Powerful men favor open combat. If the Pandavas are our enemies, then let us march out to the battlefield and settle this dispute." Shukuni's lips tightened. Then he smiled slightly. "My child, you are powerful but foolish. It seems you have forgotten Bhima's superhuman strength. And do you not remember the incident at Kampilya? All of the Kaurava princes, with you by their side, could not overpower Drupada. But with only four fighting, the Pandavas were successful. It is unlikely that we will win in a confrontation with those five brothers. Take heed of my words." Reminded of Kampilya, Karna was embarrassed. He let out an angry shout. They had been taken advantage of by surprise. Drupada had been stronger than they had expected. The Pandavas had the advantage, confronting Drupada after having witnessed his actual power. Next time, if the Pandavas confronted the Kauravas directly, things would be different. Karna shook his head and left the room. "Do what you will, but I cannot be party to such cowardice." the cunning Shakuni, carefully assessed the situation. He pressed Duryodhana to approach his father and ask for the Pandavas to be sent away. He knew that Dhritarashtra would not refuse his son anything. Duryodhana nodded slowly. He trusted Shakuni's judgment. Together, they worked out the details of their plan. Then, Duryodhana went to see the king. Then there's a break. Dhritarashtra knew well of his son's hatred for the Pandavas. He knew that Yudhisthira's installation as the heir apparent had been a bitter blow to Duryodhana. The king thought about what he could do for his sons. He had spoken with Shakuni, his brother-in-law, knowing that Dhritarashtra can never act without counsel. He had suggested that he seek advice from Shakuni's Brahmin friend, Kanika. This Brahmin, Shakuni had said, was an expert in statecraft and politics. Shakuni then personally brought Kanika to see Dhritarashtra. Kanika told Dhritarashtra that he should feel no compunction about rooting out his enemies before they harmed him. If he saw the Pandavas as his enemies, then he should destroy them without hesitation by any means possible. Because they were stronger than his own sons, a direct confrontation would probably fail. Better to employ some devious means. In the meantime, the king should continue to appear as the Pandavas' well-wisher. Then, as soon as the opportunity arose, he should strike. Dhritarashtra thanked the Brahmin for his advice and dismissed him. He sat alone in his chamber for some time. The thought of killing Pandu's sons distressed him. Perhaps there was some other way they could be removed from Hastinapur. While they were present, his own sons would never be happy. Duryodhana complained constantly about his cousins. Now the monarchy was about to pass to Pandu's line. Dhritarashtra had enjoyed his opportunity to occupy Hastinapur's throne as the world emperor. Although the firstborn son, and thus the first in the line for the throne, he had thought his blindness had forever denied him of a chance to be king. But in the years since Pandu's departure, he had become accustomed to holding the reins of power. It would not be easy to let go. And then the intrigue goes on. Duryodhana enters while Dhritarashtra is pondering like this. And so, the ill advice of the three, well, at least it's Dushasana, Shakuni, Karna here didn't like that plan. Section. Fast forwarding some more advice from Shakuni. After the visit made by Shakuni and Duryodhana to the palace that Mayadhanava had created for the Pandavas at Indraprastha and where water looked like land and land looked like water, and he fell into the water and Shakuni pulled him out, and all the queens of Kuru laughing. Yudhisthira said, "Don't laugh, it's not nice. Krishna said, no, let them laugh. As he made his way back to Hastinapur, Duryodhan sat brooding and miserable in his chariot. Shakuni asked, what ails you, O king? Why are you sighing again and again? The prince looked distractedly at Shakuni. Oh, uncle, I'm filled with jealousy to see the world under the Pandava's sway because half the kingdom had been given to them. Having witnessed their astounding sacrifice and seeing them shining like gods in heaven, my heart burns day and night. Indeed, I am drying up like a shallow pool in the summer sun. Duryodhan gazed out of his chariot at the rolling countryside with its well-tilled fields and blossoming orchards. Groups of villagers stood and watched as the royal procession moved along the road. The prince continued, when Krishna killed Shishupal, no kings dared to speak. They were all awed by the Pandava's might, or else how could they have tolerated such an injustice? Duryodhan wrung his hands. I cannot tolerate it. I shall therefore enter fire, drown myself, or swallow poison. What man who possesses any prowess at all can bear to see his enemies prosper? How can I ever equal their power and opulence? Who can help me achieve such influence? Fate is supreme, and men's exertions useless. All my efforts to destroy the Pandavas have failed. Instead, they flourish like lotuses in a lake. Therefore, I should die. Know that I am in the grip of grief, O uncle, and please inform my father. Shakuni moved closer to his nephew. Oh, Duryodhan, do not envy the Pandavas. They are receiving what is rightfully theirs, due to their own deeds. They have half of the kingdom, and with Krishna's help and Draupadi's alliance, they have grown rich. What is there to be sorry about? More to come. The Gandhar ruler smiled as he spoke. His eyes narrowed slightly, and he fingered his jeweled rings. Your cousins have conquered the world and now possess unlimited wealth. Why do you grieve? This wealth can now be yours. You said there are none to help you, but I do not agree. You have 100 brothers, the greatly powerful Drona, Karna, the invincible chariot warrior Kripa, and my brothers, along with the mighty Somadatta, stand ready at your command. Take the earth and rule it without any rival. Duryodhan's eyes widened. He sat up straight in his leather upholstered seat. Perhaps his uncle was right. The core of his strength was hard to rival. Drona, Bhishma, Kripa, Karna, who could face these men when they stood together in battle? Duryodhan spoke eagerly. O king, if you think it wise, then I shall conquer the Pandavas. The whole world shall be mine, along with the magnificent Maya Sabha. That's their palace. Shakuni slowly shook his head. He played with a set of dice he carried with him everywhere. Do not be rash, O king. There are many ways to overcome an enemy apart from battle. We cannot conquer in battle the Pandavas, especially when they are united with Krishna. Not even Indra with all the celestial celestials could overpower them. I was thinking of another way by which they can be defeated. Shukuni suggested that they challenge Yudhisthira to a game of dice. He knew Yudhisthira was fond of playing, and also that he was not expert at dice. Shukuni had no equal anywhere in the world. Without a doubt, Yudhisthira will accept your challenge, Shukuni continued, his long arm resting on Duryodhana's shoulder. He cannot resist the game, and with a little encouragement, he will surely gamble away all his possessions. Thus, I will win for you his entire kingdom and wealth. So, even good persons, what to speak of envious persons, in the association, in that association, can become corrupted. So there's Shukuni, and you know these the planned the House of Lack plan. Dushasha was right in there with the skullduggery. What about Karna? What was the ill advice of Karna? He didn't agree to trickery, and you know, he was consistently chivalrous. But what was the ill advice of Karna? Disgracing Draupadi because he had this get back mentality towards Draupadi because she had prevented him from taking part in her Svayambar. So his advice to Duryodhana, then in turn the instruction to Dushasana, to disrobe Draupadi, Karna. And Duryodhana gave the word. So by by bad association, the verse is saying, by bad association, all the power and wealth and life of Duryodhana were taken because of the intricacy of ill advice given by Karna, Dushasana, and Sobala. And then the other part we discussed already. When he lay on the ground with his followers, his thighs broken, although he was so powerful, the Lord was not happy to see the scene. And as Prabhupada points out, it was all by his doing. Krishna, the battle itself, and the particulars of how the invincible Karna could be destroyed. Because that part of his body which Gandhari was not able to see when she took her blindfold off was covered, again by Krishna's advice. You can't stand before your mother naked. Put on a gumsha. And when she removed her blindfold, the other parts of his body were invincible, but that part was vulnerable. And Krishna knew. But that's where Bhima struck. And it's a similar discussion to Ram's killing Vali from behind a tree. So Duryodhana's insults or challenge to Krishna, you know, why you have done this non-kshatriya-like act. for one who has done all of what Dushasana has done, punishment was indeed required and appropriate. So, watch out for bad association. Don't hang out with Karna or Dushasana or Shakuni or such type of people. This confidential discussion with such people should not take place, because surely they'll offer bad advice. And even a good person can be corrupted by that. Anything? Comments or questions?
Regarding the point of the distinction that you were making between the basic dharma, which is following the laws of nature, versus the transcendental, where one is aware of the purpose behind it. So, where one sticks to simply just the rules and regulations, wouldn't that just come under the Niyamagraha principle, that like one is just abiding by the rules but not knowing the purpose? And so it is not appropriate in that sense.
Well, bhakti, the verse specifically says that bhakti is destroyed. Shadbir bhaktir vinashati.
Yes. So they would, it would kind of act as a hindrance for them to come to the platform of bhakti.
Yes. That's right. If one is unwilling to examine and then enter into the realm of doing this, following the laws, so that the personality of Godhead is pleased. If you take away "so that the personality of Godhead is pleased," what do you have left? You have "so that I can prosper." You have material life, even in the name of religion. Religion so that I can prosper. The enjoying spirit is fed religiously, but it's fed. Major distinction. Although, you know, it looks subtle, it's not so subtle. Anything else?
Guru Maharaj, like when Vidura is advising Dhritarashtra to abandon his child when he was born, he was not able to do, and then later in front of his life, when Vidura comes back out of his travels and then advises him to be welcome and go to the falls, and then so the same person, he was able to take that advice. So I was thinking, like, similarly, in my life, that good advices are provided, but at times it's one can't let go, and another time one can easily let go. So what is that? What was the transformation in his heart to do?
Well, there's some obvious things. One was, with Dhritarashtra still, with Duryodhan still alive, there was some hope. And later, Duryodhan was no longer alive, nor his other 99 sons. No hope. And a second major distinction is, before, the Vidura before and Vidura after his pilgrimage. One was, he was the wise Vidura, and the other was the Mahabhagavata Vaishnava, at least in terms of the Leela. When you're receiving advice in the heat of the moment, it may be more difficult to receive it than afterwards.
So, Guru Maharaj, like, is it that Duryodhan was anyways to be killed, whether Dhritarashtra had followed that advice earlier or later? It's just that that had to happen, but his hope, false hope, like, well, the whole thing is a passion, but in terms of learning from it, that when we hold on to false hopes, then it just takes longer for Krishna's plan to manifest.
And something that can diminish false hopes, not necessarily eliminate it, but at least diminish it, is religious principle. Because his false hope was contrary to religious principle. But he was ready to go there because he had this strong desire. So he was able to look, you know, on the other side of religious principle and go there. And rationalize it away. Or say to Vidura, or say to Akura, what you say is true, but I can't follow it. Something else?
Yeah. You know, it's regarding point about, you didn't specifically mention, but something that I'm struggling with is when there is some power, there is this tendency to take advantage of it, and it manifests as, you know, say being hard on others, or
some power within oneself, or some power within,
yeah, power that we acquire by devotional service, like some maturity in Krishna consciousness or mode of goodness or whatever, then there's this tendency to
misuse it,
and like I'm repeatedly struggling with that actually, and not always but on a frequent basis. So it's I think it's impacting those that are dependent on me, or like especially say my wife or those I'm trying to cultivate. It comes out as very strong behavior, or you know, maybe like punishment is a strong word, but you know.
I gotcha.
Yeah.
So your question is?
So I was wondering if you could, I heard your lecture on Ramayana where Mother Sita is giving.
But it's two things. Two things immediately come to mind: humility and mood of service. So, to use appropriately that which has been given to you is the mood of service. And to stay, to assist one to stay in the mood of service, only for that purpose should something be utilized, is humility. Humility is a spiritual conception. Who are we? We're servants. So how can we use something given to us other than for service?
Mm.
And service means for elevation. Not that my wishes are to be served, Krishna's wishes are to be served in a way that's pleasing to Krishna. And that's those are not just counterweights, those are humility is a necessity for entering into devotional service, and devotional service is the neutralizer or, you know, eradicator of abusive tendencies, or taking something given and using it in a wrong way. Service in all situations, and then that can spill over into situations where you may use or exercise some strength improperly. Mm. Mood of service and humility.
When I think about this attachment, even when there is no dependent, there is already attachment. So I'm just being very concerned. But it's so scary what happened to the Russia. It's so scary what happened to the Russia.
Yeah.
That he couldn't even correct his son.
Well, he was a special case. You're not good for us. Categories are religious principles and bhakti. Religious principles can help regulate, control, and neutralize attachment tendencies. You act because it is to be done. You know, you that overrides attachment because it's to be done or not to be done. It's dharma, so it's to. My attachment is not, it falls into a lesser position than that which is to be done or not to be done. So, that's the counterweight to attachment. And then, in that atmosphere of the quality of goodness, devotion. Due to attachment, what's pleasing to those who are I'm serving. And that when the object is a spiritual object with a spiritual conception, then you're protected. So the strength of those relationships become very important to uplift one beyond one's own capacity. Anything else? Yeah.
I just want to clarify the point that you have made about that envy can be eradicated by religious principles. So is the
point it can be regulated. And it can be put in its proper place. Eradication, it can be checked, mm-hmm. but not eradicated
by
religious principle.
That's what I mean.
The devotional service is what it takes to eliminate.
Because it removes the tendency.
Yeah.
Guru Maharaj, on obedience, I feel that, so definitely I think I've made some progress. It's not so bad, but I feel that a major challenge for me to become obedient to Guru and Krishna and to the religious higher principles, it seems like sometimes I lose sense of my own nature. Like if I become too obedient, then I'm losing sense of my own nature.
It's not that the term too obedient is let's go back and edit that. Obedient, blind obedience, not too obedient. What's too obedient? Like, you know, stay within the speed limit. Well, I was too obedient. Stay within the speed limit. When we came in, the guy said, you know, don't park down here, park up there. You park up there, and I was too obedient. Yeah, there's laws, and you follow them. But losing sense of the purpose behind that obedience is another thing. Or, like your wife was just, you know, the response I gave to her question. If the purpose is minimally purification, for that reason, then a higher reason is because that is part of my relationship. And it's not, you know, too much relationship. It's part of the relationship. The fanaticism is when the purpose is lost. Or just being rigid and thinking that's the essence of the relationship. Thank you very much.